So let's affirm our commitment to our practice and to our community by taking the refuges and precepts together. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranang gacchami. Dhammam saranang gacchami. Sangham saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi Buddham saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi Dhammam saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi Sangham saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi Buddham saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi Dhammam saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi Sangham saranang gacchami. Anatipata Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Adinadana Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Abrahmacharya Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Musawada Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Sura Merya Majapamadatana Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Vikala Bhojana Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Nacha Gita Vadita Visukadasana Malaganda Vilepana Dharana Mandana Vibhusanatana. Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Uchasayana Mahasayana Veramani Sikapadam Samadhyami. Idam me silam Magapalanyanasa Pachayo hotu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So for the last couple of weeks, I've been going through the catalog of what we can experience in the mind and body, in the present moment, what's called the Paramattha Dhammas, the things that can actually be directly experienced in this moment through the various sense organs that we have as human beings. Based on the teachings in the 5th century commentary called the Visuddhimagga, by the scholar monk Buddhaghosa. Visuddhimagga being translated as the path of purification. Purification in the sense of purifying out all those tendencies of heart and mind that lead to suffering, filtering out all of the impurities that cause us to suffer. And in the Visuddhimagga, the Buddhaghosa talks about five different aspects of insight, which is what we're here practicing, right? Insight meditation. And I've been talking about this, the first one of those that he brings up, called purification of view, which he defines as the correct seeing or the clear seeing of mental and physical phenomena. So those building blocks of experience, little moments of experience of mental and physical phenomena that make up what we call our lives. And learning to see those, learning to tune into those more and more clearly, more and more directly, with less and less of the intermediary of concept, of conceptual overlay, which is how we're all conditioned to relate to reality. So really just talking about how to be mindful of what's actually happening right now, which over the last couple of weeks I've described in a certain amount of detail, perhaps more than you would have liked, but actually could be a lot more detail. But so I've gone through what we can experience in the body, which is basically the physical senses. So there's the tactile sense of the actual flesh of the body, the nervous system, which picks up really only just temperature, you know, hot and cold, somewhere in between. It picks up mass. Is there a sense of heaviness, hardness, lightness, softness? And it picks up movement. You know, so anything from kind of gross movements of the limbs to the movement of the breath to pulsation, vibration, down to very refined, just tingling in the body. And then the other sense organs, seeing, hearing, tasting, and smelling. And that's all that goes on in the body. That's it. Those are our options as human beings. And then spending also one of these sessions talking about what goes on in the mind, using the framework of the mental aggregates, the four out of the five aggregates that deal with the mind. So what goes on in the mind? Again, relatively limited set of things. So there's thinking. We all know that one really well, our good friend thinking. There's emoting, right? What in the West we consider emotion. There's vedana, sense of pleasure, pain, or somewhere in between that's arising in every moment of experience. Perception, recognition, kind of the pre-verbal or sub-verbal recognition of what we're experiencing. And consciousness itself, just the knowing, you know, the fact that we're here and we're experiencing these things. There's experience and there's knowing of experience that's always happening if we're conscious. So I've talked about all of that, and I wanted tonight to get into kind of the point, the point of doing that, I guess. Buddhaghosa devotes a large number of page space to going through all of these things in a lot more detail than I did, and actually laying out various schemes, you know, so some a little simpler, some much more complex, depending on how much study we've done and kind of the inclination of our minds. So he presents us with a variety of different ways for kind of carving up and relating to the elements of experience. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what does all that lead to? You know, why does he bring up this approach to practice and this particular way of getting into the Dharma? And I just do want to mention that there's not only one way to do that. You know, so often we do start with tuning into the physical elements of experience, right? When we all first go to our first meditation class or come on our first retreat with a lot of beginners, like that's where we start, right? Start with the body. That's what's kind of clear and obvious and easy to relate to. And there are many teachers that work in that way, many kind of methodologies, you know, schools, traditions that work in that way, starting with the body. But there are others. There are other teachers, schools, individual ones of us who find it easier to start off by tuning into the mental sphere, you know, maybe focusing on awareness or focusing on consciousness or focusing on the mental states arising from moment to moment. And then other teachers that blend it in different ways or have, you know, many of you have practice with an assortment of teachers and had some exposure to the different kind of ins, the different entrees into this process of purification of view. So there are a lot of skillful means for actually doing this practice of purification of view, and that doesn't always look the same for each of us. So it's all okay. Whatever our own particular path is, it's all fine. So what happens as we're more able to see nama and rupa, mental and physical phenomena, more clearly? That's what I want to get into a little bit more tonight. But I wanted to just digress a little bit, as Buddhaghosa actually does in the text, to recognize that this is not easy. It's not actually trivial to get underneath or beyond or step out of all those layers of concept that we spent our entire lives, at least this one lifetime, who knows how many others, building up. You know, and many of you have seen this, are seeing this in your practice, how it's just layer upon layer upon layer of concept that we've built up until we've arrived at what we think is reality, right? So it's a big change in perspective. It's a total change in perspective. It's part of the swimming against the stream of this path to kind of, you know, reorient the whole way that we're relating to our experience and start to be able to see, okay, it's just moments of temperature. It's just moments of heaviness. It's just moments of emotion, moments of thought. To be able to look at and deconstruct our experience in that way is not easy. And I find this really interesting to play with too, you know, like as we do start to, or, you know, get more and more glimpses of how concept and experience can separate out, to see the places where it's really stuck and globbed on, the concepts to experience, and then to notice the difference when they kind of separate out, you know. So like just even, like yesterday I did a little bit of a guided reflection on seeing, and you know, I feel like seeing is one of the last bastions where concept pries loose, you know, because you just look, like I look at my hand, and there it is. That is my hand, right? You know, like just navigating kind of the visual world for those of us who our eyes worked, just plastered over with concept, right? So it's not easy to get that to come loose. These days, for a few years now, I've been using the analogy of it's like making ramen noodles. If you guys have had an experience with ramen noodles, been to college. but so you get a package of ramen noodles, and it's like this brick, right? And it's like a solid brick of, you know, all these congealed noodles that, you know, who knows what they've done to them, but they've been all smushed into a brick of noodles, you know. And you can see there's lots of different noodles in there, right? But there's just no way to pull one out, right? Like if you try to pull one out, the whole thing's just going to crumble and disintegrate. So you have to add the hot water. You have to add the magic ingredient. That loosens it all up. You have to give it time to soften, you know, let it percolate, let it, you know, do whatever magic process it does until it all loosens up, relaxes, you know, and then you can reach in and pull out just one noodle. So I find this practice of purification of view kind of like that, you know. It's like we have to like pour in all the right ingredients and let them all simmer and let everything kind of soften and relax until we can pull out that strand of feeling tone, vedana, you know, we can pull out that strand of consciousness, you know, we can pull out that strand of, you know, movement, whatever it is. So this is why we need more than just mindfulness. That's why mindfulness is not the only ingredient in this practice, even though we call it mindfulness meditation. There's a whole bunch of other supportive qualities that we need that are kind of part of that, the magic broth, part of that steaming broth that helps everything to relax and soften up. And, you know, we discover what these are as we go along, right? So compassion and metta, loving kindness, really important ingredients in that broth, right? And those are essential ingredients, really. It takes so much softening of the heart and so much opening, you know, to suffering and being able to hold that with kindness and compassion to be able just to look and see, you know, what is really going on, to be able to loosen up all those concepts, all those stories, many of which are so difficult to see what's going on. It takes qualities that you find in all of those lists, like the lists of the paramis and the spiritual powers and all these lists of supporting players in the meditations of faith, energy, concentration, wisdom, tranquility, curiosity, joy, gratitude, equanimity. I just started making a list here, things that come to mind. You know, there's so many supportive qualities that we need at different times and able to get in there deeper. You know, it can only happen in its own time. You can't make the noodles soften up any faster than they can. It was interesting one time, one of my main teachers was the late Sayadaw Upandita. He may have heard about, you can access his teachings on Dharma Seed, and he was a big influence here for many of the senior teachers, like in the 80s and 90s. But you know, he had this reputation of being a very kind of fierce teacher, a little bit of a taskmaster. You know, really he was a big teddy bear, but he just wanted you to really be able to see what's really happening. This is his one task in life, and he was really focused on it. But so one time I was with him, and the student asked him, why is it so hard to see Nama Rupa? Why is it so difficult? Because we hear these teachings, maybe we read about them, we hear them in talks like this, where it sounds very simple and straightforward, right? Like there's this basic list of things we can feel, and the instructions are just basically to sit down and be mindful and notice them, right? So why is it so hard? And I found Sayadaw's answer really interesting. He said, well, you know, the teachings are presented the way they are in the suttas and the Abhidhamma and the Visuddhimagga, especially the more analytical texts like this, the way they are for academic reasons. You know, they've all been organized so that they're very logical and very linear, and we can kind of wrap our heads around them and we can remember them and make use of them. You know, so they're really designed to be used as teaching tools, as academic tools. But he said that that we shouldn't get confused and think that it's supposed to be like that when we actually sit down on the cushion. You know, that when we sit down to do our practice, it's actually, I'm paraphrasing here, this is my take on what he said. But he said it's a whole other ball of wax, you know, that we're human beings and we're messy and we're complicated. And, you know, when we actually get down to the business of doing our practice, there's all sorts of other things in play. It's not as straightforward as just sitting down and seeing Nama Rupa until we're fully enlightened. So just to again, digress here a little bit, one of the supportive qualities that's always mentioned near the top of the lists is concentration. You know, it's one of the five spiritual powers. It's one spoke of the Eightfold Path. And there's a point that the Visuddhimagga makes, which is really relevant to the practice we're doing here today, which is that we might not actually need so much concentration as it's made out that we do in the suttas, which as some of you know, the suttas send a pretty clear message that we need to develop very strong concentration for liberation. And there's a lot of talk about the jhanas, which I've mentioned before. Some of you are practicing them here. And so, you know, I guess for centuries leading up to, you know, it's about 1,000 years between the time of the Buddha and when this commentary is written, you know, presumably for all that time, at least in many schools of Buddhism, that had been an important part of the practice, doing jhana practice, deliberately cultivating really strong concentration. And that's continued, you know, so again, there's still many schools of Buddhism today, which before you get to Vipassana practice, you got to do a lot of samatha, a lot of concentration practice, which is great. It's a great thing to be able to do if you got time for it. If you're a monk, if you're a layperson with independent means and a lot of time on your hands, you know, like some of us here have the great good fortune to be, you know, some of us have life circumstances where we can devote the time to that fairly intensive practice of developing deep concentration. But what we find in the Visuddhimagga almost kind of as an offhand aside remark, like not even as like a thing that he really talks about in great depth is, oh, well, if you're doing this without developing jhana, then here's how you do it. So this is taken as kind of the ground for the kind of practice that we do here today in modern times as lay people, with kind of many of us with a limited amount of time on our hands. So Buddhaghosa is kind of affirming in this one particular 1,500-year-old tradition that you don't really need to cultivate jhana first, that it's you can actually build enough concentration just through doing what's called bare insight or bare awareness practice. He calls those of us who don't cultivate jhana before starting insight practice dry insight workers. It's a great term, dry insight workers. So it's kind of, you know, just as kind of general knowledge, it's good to know where that comes from because that forms a lot of the kind of the justification and the basis for doing it the way that we do it here. And really our experience, you know, especially like here, you know, IMS, Forest Refuge, and this community has borne that out, you know, because over the 50 or so years that IMS has been here, you know, thousands and thousands of people have come and done this practice without cultivating jhana first and really seen benefits from it. So it's kind of like we've been a little bit of a laboratory and a test scenario for doing this way. And it seems to work. So we're here, you know, developing our concentration to whatever level feels like a good fit for us. Some of us are working more specifically on deep concentration. Some of us either not interested in that or not able to, and we're just dry insight workers, however we're doing it. But as long as we're cultivating all of those supportive qualities together with mindfulness, then the practice will unfold. So what is really happening in the present moment, one way or another, is gradually coming more into view, more into focus for us. And the Visuddhimagga, again, takes some time to reassure us that it's okay for that to be an ongoing process. And points out especially that the more subtle mental phenomena may take some time to come into focus. I really love these are like little nuggets of gold to me, these moments in the Visuddhimagga where Buddhaghosa kind of steps out of all the dry analytical exposition to kind of bring things back down to earth. This is one of the places where he does that, you know. So clearly the fact that he's mentioning this, you know, implies that, you know, these Sri Lankan monks, you know, practicing in relatively austere conditions 1,500 years ago, really not so different from us. You know, they also needed some reassurance and encouragement and needed, you know, to let the practice unfold for them in their own way, just like we do today. So Buddhaghosa encourages not to give up, to persevere, to be patient. If we can't totally see every separate strand of experience clearly yet, but just to keep at it. And specifically, he advises us to stick with the aspects of experience that are already clear. So this is actually a really important, like, practical piece of meditation instruction. Stay with what's actually clear and don't push to see what's not clear yet, what hasn't come into view yet. The methodology that he recommends is that if we just keep noticing, you know, with clarity, with awareness, what is clear to us in our experience, in our actual experience, that just of its own accord, gradually, like those ramen noodles, more and more will loosen up and come into view, just as the natural process of the Dharma unfolding, that we don't need to make it happen. And in fact, we don't want to push to try to make it happen, that's counterproductive. And he gives a bunch of similes, which I think these are all drawn from the suttas in various places, as Caroline's been treating us with. There's all this wonderful imagery in the teachings, and Buddhaghosa brings some of it in here. And he actually gives like a whole list of them. Like he gives lists of everything, so he gives a whole list of these encouraging similes as well, you know. So just a couple that kind of jumped out at me. He compares kind of the softening of concept and the revealing of the underlying nama rupa to the process of making butter. I don't know if you guys have ever done that. When my kids were little, we used to do this a lot. They really loved it. And we did this very easy process where you just take full cream, you put it in a jar, you put the lid on it, and then you shake it. And you just keep shaking it until at some point, like, all the fats glob together and fall out of the buttermilk. And you've got butter. It's like magic. You know, the kids love it. But it's a lot of, you know, you shake and they give it a couple of shakes and they're like, is it ready yet? You know, they give it a couple more shakes, is it ready? I'm like, no, you got to keep shaking it. You got to keep shaking for quite some time. Keep shaking. You know, so practice can feel like that sometimes, right? That was one I could relate to. Another one that I like is he talks about it being like polishing a mirror. you know, but this is 1,500 years ago, so a mirror then would have been like a piece of silver that had been, you know, methodically beaten until it was as smooth as they could possibly get it, right? And then, you know, painstakingly, like, buffed and polished with, you know, increasingly fine grit, and, you know, it would have been a whole to-do to make a mirror back in those days. And if you set that mirror aside and didn't take good care of it for a while, you know, if you would let it go without polishing, it would tarnish, it would get scratched up. If you want to make it shiny again and actually see your image in it, what do you got to do? You got to polish it, right? Not just like one. I don't know if you've ever, anybody here who's ever polished silver by hand, you know, not just one or two polishes, but like polish it and polish it and polish it, you know, and just, you can't rush it. You can't make it happen any faster than it's going to happen. If you give it just a couple of swipes and then try to look in it, it's not going to reflect. You have to get it good and polished, and that just takes time. So Buddhaghosa encourages us to just have this kind of patient persistence. Just keep at it until things become clearer and clearer. And it may be, you know, and this can be a little tricky, because it may be that it's sometimes we hear a certain instruction, hear something from a teacher, or get a little insight from a book or something. You know, we'll try looking at it this way. You know, this is one of the things we try to offer you guys. You know, see if you can shift your point of view to look at what's going on in this way, to see if you can get a little clearer glimpse of what's actually going on. And sometimes that works, right? You know, sometimes there's a trick or a tool. You know, sometimes there's some skillful mean that we pick up and it actually works some of the time. But that can be a little tricky territory, because all the supportive conditions have to be right there for that particular trick of the trade to work. So we've also probably all had times when we get into kind of belaboring a particular difficult experience in meditation, right? Especially at this point when we're kind of old yogis. Well, maybe if I try this tool, it'll get better. Maybe if I try this tool, it'll get better. Maybe if I just do this or do that, or, you know, I'm going to rein it, or I'm going to, you know, do this or the other thing with it, it'll get better, until at some point we kind of notice, oh, okay, we really got caught up in struggling with this and just trying to see something that's not ready to be seen yet. So this is like one of the areas of practice that requires discernment, right? You know, when are we being skillful, bringing in a little something that might help us to connect a little bit more, and when have we just gotten in a tussle with really trying to push and make things happen that are not ready to happen? So there's many points at which we need to remind ourselves to just be here in the present moment with what's actually happening, just seeing things as they're presenting it themselves, and not trying to see what we can't see yet, which I see as part of trusting the Dharma, like that taking refuge in the Dharma. When we take refuge in the Dharma, that's part of that is taking refuge in experience just as it's unfolding, right? Taking refuge in the truth of how things are. And, you know, we need to be reminded a lot that there's really no wrong experience in meditation. Really no way to do this wrong except to stop doing it. Like, the only real mistake we could make is to give up. And even then, giving up is like often part of the path, you know. So it's really, really hard to mess up, you know. So that really difficult thing that's coming up, that really painful thing that's coming up, that really confusing thing that's coming up, none of it's a mistake, right? All experience is equal from the point of view of this practice, because it doesn't matter what we're being aware of. So there's nothing that's arising that shouldn't be arising. There's nothing that we need to make arise. You know, our job as yogis is just to keep noticing what is arising, what is actually happening. Sometimes we can get caught up in trying to get back to something from past practice, right? And especially as old yogis, this is one of our bugaboos. It's like, well, we had that other retreat or that other sitting where that really great thing happened, you know, that I felt was a mark of really good practice or whatever it is that we have around it. And that should be coming again, you know, like, so what did I do last time that like led to that? And how can I get there again, right? That whole trip, really not useful. You know, Buddhaghosa is clear about that. Or, again, we may be trying to get forward to something that hasn't happened for us yet, that hasn't come into view yet. So we hear these teachings and we really want to see, oh, she's talking about that thing. That sounds really interesting. Can I find that? Where in my experience is that thing, you know, that they're talking about? Also just not useful. Mahasi Sayadaw, you know, kind of the great granddaddy of the modern insight meditation movement, Sayadaw Upandita's teacher, talked about this in some of his writings. He said that striving and trying to see what's not clear to us is like it's like trying to shoot an arrow at a bullseye, but instead of aiming at the target, we're aiming like at a point past the target. So it's just never going to connect because we're like not aiming in the right place. And he said that that overshooting, trying to like overshoot the target of what we can actually see in our own experience, just leads to agitation and to fatigue. And it actually leads to seeing things less clearly when we're trying to see things that we just can't see yet. So it's really counterproductive. And he encourages us to just, like Buddhaghosa, just relax, be patient, stay with what's actually in view, and let things unfold according to their natural lawfulness. And there may be times in practice when things become less clear, right? There can be times when we feel like we're backsliding. But if we're being diligent in our practice and we're just continuing to do the practice, you know, best we can, then we don't really need to worry about that. It's often the case, and probably you can relate to this, that when we're at those transition places where we're going deeper, there's often a place that we pass through of things seeming like they're getting worse, right? Just because, you know, we're moving on. We're moving into new territory, different terrain. You know, we've lost our grip on how things had been appearing a little while ago, and we're kind of moving into the next phase, but it hasn't really come into focus yet. So there are these kind of uncomfortable in-between places where, like, our first impulse can be like, oh, no, something's wrong. You know, I need to get back to that place a few days ago when it seemed really clear. But actually, that's counterproductive. And what we need is to just relax into that kind of like, don't know, it's not clear yet kind of space. Just keep doing the practice until the new space comes into view. So just to be patient, keep churning the butter, keep polishing the mirror. Buddhaghosa also here gives us some instructions for how to be mindful of our conceptual world that we've built up, what to do when we come up against this, all the stories, right, all those layers of concepts. So the first instruction is to see if we can see it through the lens of nama-rupa. You know, so can we take a step out of the story and see what is it actually? What is it really in this moment, right? In this moment, that story is not actually happening, right? So we have some big thought storm, or even a small thought storm. We get lost in thought. We step out of it. You know, we're here in reality again. What is that thought storm right in this moment? You know, so then we can remember, oh, is there a strand of thinking? You know, can I see the plane flying by with the banner? You know, whatever it's saying. Is there that strand of emotion? You know, can I get in touch with the emotional feeling that's going on? Maybe feel it in the body, that rupa element of it. Oh, it's making the stomach do this, or it's making the throat do this. So we can use these teachings in this way to just kind of step out of the big mindstorm and remember, okay, this is what's probably actually going on. Can I see it? But again, not to push, you know, if we don't see it, we don't see it. But to notice what we might see about it. Maybe we see a couple little things going on in there. But then Buddhaghosa said, if we come at a mind storm, we're back in the moment, and we really can't see it. It's just like a big cloud, right? Which often happens with very, you know, charged mind storms. You know, there's some big drama going on, and we really just can't get any clear perspective on what it actually is in the moment. Then he said, just move on, right? Which this is kind of the standard instruction when we're beginners, when we wake out of thought, right? Just come back to the breath. Just come back to the anchor. You know, so again, I'm paraphrasing here, but he's like, okay, take a look at it. If you can see something that's really happening in the present moment in the mind or the body related to that, then notice it. But if you can't, just move on. Just come back to a breath or hearing or anything. Again, this is the staying with what's clear. Just come back to anything that's actually clear in the present moment, and don't push to try to bring clarity where there just isn't any. So two-part instructions. If you can break it down into nama rupa, great. If not, just come back to some nama rupa that is clear. So seeing nama rupa more and more clearly in and of itself is a kind of insight, right? It's this insight into what's really going on, what's really happening. But it's also a springboard for deeper insight, which is really the direction that this is meant to go. So when we get to a place where we can see more and more of those strands of the ramen noodles separately and distinctly, and we can see that passing stream of mental and physical phenomena, then deeper insight can arise out of that. Seeing that passing parade of, you know, now there's a moment of this, and now there's a moment of this, right? And we have times in the practice where it really seems like that, where it really looks like a parade. You know, it's like, okay, here goes movement, and here goes, you know, pleasantness, and, you know, we can kind of see each float in the parade passing by. Just recently, we had our local 4th of July parade down where I live outside of D.C., and every year we go and we camp out in a friend's driveway. We have some friends that their house is right on the parade route, on the main street that the parade goes through. And we live in this interesting community. It's sometimes called the Berkeley of D.C. It's a lot of free spirits and a lot of very left-leaning and creative people, artsy people. So, you know, there's various interesting things that in our parade that you might not usually encounter, like the push mower drill team is always a highlight. You know, there's a bunch of guys with their push mowers, and it's kind of like synchronized swimming. They do like formations and like fancy maneuvers and stuff. It's great. Everybody loves the push mower drill team. This year, there's also like a bicycle-powered butterfly float, which was like 10 people on bicycles that they'd all kind of like managed to put in a big array and then big wings on it, and they bicycle down the street. There was also the Rainbow Poodle Brigade, which was a bunch of people that had, you know, cut their poodles into those stereotypical haircuts with like the big poofy heads and tails and ankles and things, and then dyed them all rainbow colors. So this is our local 4th of July parade. But, you know, so with the parade, you know, we camp out there on our friend's driveway, and it's like, here comes the power mower, the push mowers, you know, and they like come by, they do their little routine, and then they keep going, right? Here come the poodles, and all the rainbow poodles come by, you know, and they do their thing, and then they go on. Here comes the bicycle butterfly, oh, isn't it cool with the big wings, you know, and it goes on and does its thing. And again, this is my metaphor for the flow of nama rupa, you know. That's what it looks like sometimes. You know, each float, nama rupa, each one with its own particular quirks, right? Some moments are hot, some moments are cold, some moments are pleasant, some moments are unpleasant. Each kind of doing its own thing and then moving on. And at some point, you know, we're able to really get this. You know, after the noodles have softened up a bit, we can really get this. And it's just one thing after another. Like, that's all that's happening. Just one thing after another, moment by moment by moment in our experience. So, this, you know, it's easy, relatively, to get this intellectually. Harder to get it experientially, which is what really matters for insight. This is the deeper aspect of purification of view. Seeing that this is all there really is. It's just this passing parade. Moment of this, moment of that, moment of this, moment of that. On and on and on and on and on. That is what we call life. And you know, the mind also makes the connection at some point that it's not just now. So we may see that in this moment, okay, here comes this thing, here comes this thing. At some point, the mind, or the heart, really, connects the dots and gets, oh, you know, there's that like kind of light bulb goes off and there's that flash of intuitive insight. It's always like this, right? It's always been like this. It's always going to be like this. This is it. There isn't any other game in town. This is what's called inferential insight. So again, it's not an intellectual insight. And it's also not seeing it in the moment, but it's kind of that leap of intuition that extrapolates what we're seeing in the moment to, you know, everything that's come before and everything that will come after. And this is really the seeing of anatta, seeing of non-self or emptiness, which is not actually anything particularly complicated or esoteric. You know, getting into a philosophical discussion of non-self or anatta, emptiness, can be a big rabbit hole. You know, it can get very heady, very complicated, very quickly. But the actual experience of it in the moment is fairly straightforward. It's just simply a question of gathering all this data, moment by moment by moment, and then seeing the pattern, seeing that there just isn't anything else. there's just nothing else there. It's just moments of nama and rupa, you know, flowing by. So it's almost like insight via process of elimination. You know, it's almost like we arrive at that understanding of anatta just by ruling out everything else that it could possibly be. You know, we keep watching that parade go by and go by and go by. And at some point, there's just a critical mass of evidence. You know, I've been watching this. You know, how long have I been doing this practice? I've been watching this, you know, this whole sitting, this whole walking, this whole hour, this whole day, this whole week, this whole month, this whole year, this whole decade, you know, however long it's been. And at some point, the force of just the data is, you know, too much to be ignored. The heart gets it, you know. This is all that's going on here. So a lot of the time when we're deepening in this insight into no self, we don't even realize it's happening, because it's not like we're seeing no self. There's not any no self to see. We're seeing the absence of self, which isn't like a thing. It's not an event. We're seeing everything that's not self instead of seeing no self, if that makes any sense. Because we're just watching those physical and mental phenomena go by. It's not really anything special, but still the heart is getting it. You know, the heart is gathering that data. It's really, you know, it's a leap of faith, but it's important to understand that insight really doesn't happen on the intellectual level. You know, once there is insight, it may be intellectualized. It may hit the intellectual mind and then be articulated. But it doesn't need to, even really. And most of the time, it's not. We're still getting that message on the deeper level. You know, just as we sit here and we kind of feel, you know, the body, notice the mind, things flowing by, we're getting that insight. It's happening. We can trust the Dharma. We can take refuge in that aspect of the Dharma. We can take refuge in just the natural process of the unfolding of the Dharma. It will happen whether we like it or not. It'll happen whether we think it's happening or not. You know, we can't make it happen. We can't make it not happen. It'll just happen through this process. I'll end with one last story here from my practice, from a time that I was in Burma practicing some decades ago, and working on this aspect of the practice, working on purification of view, you know, trying to untangle those noodles, soften them up, try to see all the different strands of physical and mental phenomena. And I was coming in every day, as you do, at Sayadaw Pandita's monastery, and reporting to my teacher, one of his head teachers, on my experience. And so every day I'd come in and say, you know, I feel the breath, and I notice that there's pressure, and there's tension, and then there's relaxing and softening, and, you know, kind of like that. And then I feel the walking, and I notice that there's heat and then movement, and, you know, that's how you do it in that tradition. You give this blow by blow of the nama and the rupa that you've noticed as you're sitting and walking, and then maybe some other things. So I was doing this day after day after day after day for some weeks, until it was just always the same routine, until one day I came in and I gave my report, and Saida asked me through the translator, what is your mother? Which I think I looked at the translator, I was like, what? Are you sure you got that right? But he was a very good translator. He never actually made any mistakes. And yeah, he looked at Saida. Saida looked back at him. He said, yeah, what is your mother? So I reflected, what is my mother? And, you know, in the place that I was in my practice in that point, it became really clear just as I was sitting there remembering my mother. She was a flow of nama and rupa, right? I was having memories, I was having emotions with those, I had some feelings in the body, right? Visual image, you know. I said, nama rupa, she's nama rupa. And I laughed, because it just seemed so absurd in that moment, you know, like this, my mother, you know, I have a fraught relationship with my mother, like many of us. And then, but in that moment, it's just so clear. Oh, she's just a passing stream of nama and rupa, just a passing stream of physical and mental phenomena. So I kind of burst out laughing, and to my surprise, Sayadaw laughed too, which is the only time I ever saw him laugh. You know, a lot of these, you know, the monks, they're very, you know, serious, and you know, and he laughed, and then he asked me like another question. He asked me like, "What's your father?" And I reflected, "Oh yeah, nama rupa," and we laughed some more, and he, like we had this we yucked it up there for a little while. He asked me a string of these questions, and I could really see each one of these, you know, concepts is just a string of nama rupa. There's really nothing more to it than that. And, you know, anything else that I piled on top of that was just really optional. You know, so it was just so freeing. So, you know, that thing that we love most in the world, you know, whatever it is for us, what is it really? Nama rupa. That thing that we hate most in the world, that causes us the most pain, what is it really? Nama rupa. So the more that we come to understand this, again, you know, not as an idea, but actually seeing and actually feeling it experientially, the more it weakens, you know, all of that stuff, all of that baggage that we have around what we think is going on in our lives, the more it weakens the force of craving and aversion and delusion around, you know, the conceptual world that we inhabit. And the less inclined the heart is to get caught up and struggling with all of that. You know, it's there may be compelling reasons for having a lot of craving and aversion around our mothers, but it's a lot harder to get worked up around a stream of nama rupa. You know, it's just not as, doesn't have as much charge to it. What is there really to try to hang on to? What is there really to try to push away? It's all just going anyway, right? It's all just part of the parade. It's all just going by. So the more that we get that, the more we can just relax, let the parade do its thing, let each thing pass by according to its own nature. And this is part of the path towards liberation. You know, liberation from that obsession and that fascination with all of the concept-constructed realities that we inhabit. All of the ignorance, this is what's meant by ignorance and delusion, is being confused, thinking that all of the concept-constructed realities have some intrinsic reality, have some intrinsic truth to them, not seeing them for what they actually are. So the better that we understand what's actually happening now, just all of those really boring, simple moments of nama and rupa, the freer we become. And until we're fully enlightened, there's always more to discover. That's kind of a given. You know, if we're still suffering, there's still layers of concept that are stuck onto our actual experience. There's still the mirror is still tarnished, it's still cloudy, we're not seeing clearly yet. Which is actually one of the aspects of this practice that I just love. This is what keeps it really rich for me. You know, the fact that there is always something new to discover, at least for now. Maybe eventually we'll get there. But every time I come across some new place in my experience that's covering up what's really happening, some new wisp of concept, you know, some area where I haven't seen how I'm layering on a story, layering on an interpretation. Even just getting a glimpse of that, it's like discovering an Easter egg, right? It's like, oh, goody, you know, here's a new layer of delusion, you know, that's starting to come loose in the broth, you know? It's like, it's such a joy. It's part of the joy of being on the path. It's really the path of discovery, you know? It's so exciting, really. You know, it's just a really wonderful process. And then every time, you know, that one, some new piece of concept does come loose and we come more fully into contact with things as they really are, there's that deeper sense of satisfaction, you know, that deepening of really being in the flow, right? Resting more and more fully in the flow. We all know what that feels like, that coming into deeper contact with what's really going on in whatever way we understand that, however we interpret that. And having that real sense of presence and connection, how that soothes the heart and really satisfies the heart in this deep way that living in that world of concept just doesn't do. Okay, that's it for tonight. So we'll wrap it up by sharing the merit of our practice together. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of Death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.